I don't know if I ever told you about my doctoral dissertation. Let the yawning begin now. I will not describe it to you now. But there was this one aspect of it one could find mildly entertaining or worthy of mockery, perhaps. My dissertation involved statistics, that is, comparing A to B and C and D with a desire to know how often they correlated. Shoot, just the fact that I just used the word correlated ought to tell you I know what I'm talking about. I did this research over a period of months involving more than 100 subjects. I gathered all the data wherein I proceeded to carefully consider the correlations. I discovered that my hypotheses, another bit of evidence, this was real research, my hypotheses were right an astounding some of the time and wrong a disappointing rest of the time. In order to account for the observed phenomena, I drafted equations, wrote them into real words, cobbled them into paragraphs, and presented them to my academic advisor. Her immediate response was that I find a mathematician who could verify my statistical analysis, or perhaps school me in the discipline of statistical analysis. So I did. Dr. Larry, someone. Nice guy. Dr. Larry read my draft and wrote this in his brief approval of my work. While her methods do not rise to the level of conventional classical statistics, somehow it all adds up. Really. I'm telling you this because this week I discovered a helpful online tool, not for statistical analysis, but for scoring people as to whether or not they may be crackpots. That's right. Technically, it was written for physicists, but I think it applies equally well to other disciplines. Here's a sampling. As you review your scholarly work, it says, and I don't know, but scholarly may have been in quotation marks, you should give yourself 5 points for each statement that is adhered to despite careful correction. 5 points for each word in all capital letters, except for those who have defective keyboards. 10 points for pointing out that you have gone to school, as if this were evidence of sanity. 10 points for offering prize money to anyone who proves and/or finds any flaws in your theory. 10 points for arguing that a current well-established theory is only a theory, as if this were somehow a point against it. 20 points for every use of science fiction works or myths as if they were fact. 20 points for defending yourself by bringing up real or imagined ridicule according to your past theories. 30 points for claiming that your theories were developed by an extraterrestrial civilization without good evidence. 40 points for comparing those who argue against your ideas to Nazis, stormtroopers, or brown shirts. I did not get any points for any of those. But then I saw this. 10 points for each statement along the lines of, I'm not good at math, but my theory is conceptually right, so all I need is for someone to express it in terms of equations. Even I could see the similarity to the statistical challenge I presented Dr. Larry a decade ago. And since the quiz gives every person who takes it a -5 starting score, I actually scored +5, a positive result on the crackpot scale, without even taking the whole thing. I just thought you would want to know. The quiz was written by an actual professor at a real university, Dr. John Baez, which I thought was probably a little prank God was pulling since I had been Googling Joan Baez. I was trying to refresh my memory regarding a comment she made in sometime in the mid-1980s when she greeted the crowd at a Live Aid concert in Philadelphia with this proclamation, "This is your Woodstock, and it is long overdue." Woodstock, of course, for those who don't read the papers, was a concert in New York in 1969, wherein hundreds of thousands of people got rained on and mud-caked, where careers were launched and sleeping bags were shared, where music and various other substances filled the air. Woodstock wasn't even Woodstock at that time. It only became something after the movie told us all about it, told us it was something. Kurt Vonnegut called it politically useless in a PBS interview in 1994. Morris Dickstein said, "So many people think they were at Woodstock, but they only saw the movie." Neither of those folks made any mention of Live Aid at all, which really serves to make a point here. And I'm guessing you're wondering what it possibly could be. Most world-changing events are clearest in retrospect. We are much better at hindsight than foresight. And then I read again Mark's gospel reading. Today is the beginning of Advent, which is the beginning of a new year in church. We shift from Matthew's gospel to Mark's, and we will read it pretty regularly until next November. And we begin at a fairly odd and confusing place. Not the beginning of the book, but the part said to be Jesus' farewell address to the disciples. He gives this speech, which is actually all of chapter 13, and then he is arrested, according to Mark. And it is kind of a weird speech. It is often called the little apocalypse, the kind of Bible passage which lends credence to those street corner preachers, best-selling authors, who so often think they can tell you about the end of the world. People I generally think of as crackpots, to tell you the truth. There are parts of the Bible that read more like science fiction than sacred inspiration, and this is one of them. Some people want to believe it tells us a truth about Jesus' life, and others claim it gives us clues to whatever might lie in our near future or our far-off future. But what it mostly does is tell us about Mark, about what he was experiencing at a particular time, about 30 years or so after Jesus was executed. Mark wrote about Jesus from the perspective of his own era, his own life, which is really the most that most of us can do most of the time. Politically, Mark's time was chaotic, similar to Jesus' time, but sort of amped up. Roman occupation, social unrest, deteriorating economy, false prophets, bandits popping up all over the place. Caligula riled the people when he announced plans to install a statue of himself in the Jewish temple to make himself their god. A desecrating sacrilege, perhaps the sacrilege that Mark mentions a few verses before our reading begins today. An awful horror, one translator called it. In the year 66, the simmering Jewish resistance broke into open revolt, which ultimately failed. In 70, General Titus, on behalf of Rome, destroyed the temple. The temple, the holiest place. The thing worth fighting over. A chaotic time, a messy, difficult time. And if you were a follower of a man who was executed as a threat to the state, there was really no reason to expect you were about to fare better than he did. And then a farewell speech. The other gospels have farewell speeches. In Matthew, the disciples get a task. We call it the Great Commission. Go ye therefore and baptize, etc., etc. In Luke, the comfort of normal things. Jesus appears on the road to Emmaus as the disciples are pondering what just happened here. And he has a meal with them. And John, well, we love John's speech. We use it a lot at funerals, various parts of it. In my Father's house are many rooms. I'm going to go prepare a place for you. Peace I give to you. Don't let your hearts be troubled. Love one another as I have loved you. No greater love is there than someone giving his or her life for a friend. I am the vine and you are the branches. Four chapters of encouragement and good feelings. Mark's farewell speech, on the other hand, reads more like a scene from Die Hard 2 or Apocalypse Now or The Morning After. Any movie that you walk out of wondering who's going to repopulate the earth. And in the midst of this farewell speech Mark has written for Jesus, there is a parable, a short parable. It's like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his slaves in charge, each with his work, and he commands the doorkeeper to be on the watch. And this time, unlike the other parables that we've read lately, this time we're supposed to presume that the main character really is Jesus. Jesus is leaving. The ones who have had no power at all are now to be in charge. And somebody needs to keep an eye on the door. Keep an eye on the door, maybe for someone to return, for this guy to return. Maybe for odd things that are going to happen outside the door. The reading is kind of a puzzle. But Mark clears it up. You don't know, he says, if the master will come in the evening or at midnight or at cockcrow or at dawn. And this is chapter 13 of Mark. And in chapter 14, each of those things will take on new meaning. Evening was Jesus' last meal with his friends. Midnight was his arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane. Cockcrow was the moment that Peter saved himself by claiming not to know Jesus at all. And dawn was the final appearance before the council and Pilate when he was condemned to die. In the parable, in the little apocalypse, Mark is telling us things that have happened already. And then he says, no sleeping. Do not fall asleep like you did in the garden that night. Shake off sleep, clear out the cobwebs. Following Jesus leads to death, an ugly death. Naivete is a prelude to disaster, wrote one scholar examining this text. Don't think this life in Jesus will be easy, that you won't be challenged even by people you have known your whole life. And so it goes. I will continue to believe that people who claim knowledge of the end of time are crackpots. But the chaos goes on. This week, a grand jury in Missouri declined to indict Darren Wilson, the white police officer who shot Michael Brown to death. This week, Ferguson is in pain. Chaos is winning. The future looks bleak. And it is hard to hope that anything will ever be different. Martin Luther King Jr. said that riots are the language of the unheard. And for those who ask the question of why people would burn their own neighborhoods, another writer said this, because they feel so dispossessed that their neighborhoods don't seem like theirs at all. This week, on the same day that Ferguson learned Officer Wilson would not be charged, Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner, and James Cheney were awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. They were not there at the White House to accept it, of course. They were murdered in 1964, trying to register black voters in Mississippi. Law enforcement officers were complicit in their deaths, claims one widow. In 1964. Then in 1968, Dr. King was killed. and riots broke out in 125 American cities. In 1969, Woodstock. Woodstock was pivotal, a movement for peace, folks say in retrospect, some folks. The president, President Obama, thinks the deaths of Michael James and Andrew were pivotal. Their deaths shook the conscience of our nation, said the president. They lived with the idealism and courage of youth, he said. They could not have known the impact they would have on the civil rights movement or future generations. We are so much better at hindsight than foresight. And why does it feel like 50 years later we haven't gotten anywhere? Woodstock didn't help, though a lot of people got stoned trying. 125 burning cities did not fix it, and some of those cities never completely recovered. Killing 3 civil rights workers did not make it better, apologies to our president. Their deaths were just the tip of a very deadly iceberg. Hundreds, thousands, how many killed in the service of power? Tens of thousands, millions of lives changed forever? Days before he died, Michael Brown said this to his mother. I've been dreaming of death, seeing pictures of death, seeing pictures of bloody sheets hanging on clotheslines. Was Michael a foreteller? Was Mark the gospel writer? The race-based hatred in our country is not the whole problem, but it is a vivid metaphor for all that we face, for all the things that we do poorly or don't do at all or keep doing over and over again or can't imagine undoing. 50 years later, cities burn. 2,000 years later, Mark's reality seems hauntingly familiar, dangerously familiar, painfully familiar, not as a future threat, but as a current reality. The emperor still wants a place in our holiest spaces. And the church celebrates Advent again, with no reason to think that it will change anything, but the gnawing deep belief that it changes everything. A promise that this will pass. Michael Brown's family pastor is in the news now, and he is in the line of fire. Pastor Carlton Lee of the Flood Christian Church intended to stay out of the limelight. Since the day Michael died, Pastor Lee has let the prominent news leaders, national leaders, speak out on behalf of the city and the family, on behalf of justice. But when the grand jury decided not to indict the police officer, Pastor Lee decided he needed to be a public voice. And when he spoke out, he became a target. He received more than 70 death threats. And this one stood out for him. I'm going to come pick you up with all you other hateful nigger preachers and put you all in your church and burn you straight to hell. The language tears our hearts, assaults our ears, rips our sense of civility. It was painful to say it out loud. But brutally honest reporting is required because glossing or editing makes a hateful story more palatable and also makes it less powerful. Hateful speech. First, the hateful speech. Then Monday night, someone torched his church. The church Pastor Lee had put his life savings into buying, his life's energy into building. While he was putting himself on the line elsewhere, putting out fires and chasing off looters on the main drag in Ferguson, someone set his church on fire. Pastor Carlton Lee did what Jesus did. Stood on the side of the dispossessed, the downtrodden, the deliberately detached, and said, "This is wrong." And someone set his church on fire. Mark, the gospel writer, said, "Times are ugly." Pastor Lee knows what that means. Naivete is a prelude to disaster, according to Mark's version of Jesus' farewell speech. Don't think this life of faith will be easy. Follow a guy who got executed by the system and expect the worst. Someone will want to burn you straight to hell. And all we have is Advent. A faint promise that we remember for a season each year. A faint promise which sometimes gets lost in the shuffle of Christmas. A promise that gets muffled by Christmas carols sung too soon. We are the church. We are the ones who proclaim hope. Today at Woodside, with churches all over the world, we light the first candle of Advent, a candle of hope, and we share a meal of holy presence. Today at Woodside, with churches all over the world, we light a candle. In Missouri today, the members of Flood Christian Church are worshiping in their parking lot. In winter, in Missouri, with no walls to protect them and violent forces all around them, forces that have promised to do them harm, they gather in the parking lot to worship. By their very exposed worship, they declare their defiant faith that God is a God of justice, that there is reason to hope, that Advent is the beginning of something. And perhaps by their defiance, we grade them a few points higher on the crackpot scale. We are the clay, and God is the potter, wrote Isaiah. Apparently, we all are broken pots, cracked or chipped, or leaking or leading fragmented lives. Can cracked pots proclaim wholeness? O come, Emmanuel. Amen.